It's a story that began almost two decades ago now. It circulated widely for months and is still believed by many around the world. The September 11th, 2001 attacks. Some believe that the attacks on the Trade Center had been foretold by the 16th century French writer Nostradamus. Now, he wrote an ambiguous, nearly unintelligible sets of prose called quatrains, and believers and followers claim that these quatrains predict everything from the Civil War to the JFK assassination. One supposed text of Nostradamus reads, "In the city of God, there will be great thunder. Two brothers torn apart by chaos while the fortress endures. The great leader will succumb. The third war will begin when the city is burning." This text was actually published on a Canadian website as part of an essay on how easily an important sounding prophecy can be created using vague imagery. And it was accredited to Nostradamus as an experiment. But what began as essentially a skeptical piece explaining how prophecy can fool people eventually circulated as the real thing. When I think about that, I ask the question, well, what is the real thing like? You know, is it like, you know, you get the little astrology tips in the coffee news? Is it like that, those vague things you read? Is it like Nostradamus' quatrains? Are they vague? Are they unintelligible? What is real prophecy like? How can we be certain that the prophecies that we read in Daniel, that we know what they mean? And how can we be certain of their fulfillment? It's something that I want to look at today because we are going to be digging into a more historical element in these prophecies today. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 8. You want to go ahead and turn there, meet me there. And we're going to be dealing with what was fulfilled in history but was 200 years in the future for Daniel. We're going to see 10 incredible prophecies predicted at least 200 years out and fulfilled. They're history for us. But before we move to this new section of Daniel today, I want to give a quick summary of his message in chapter 2 through 7. I want to make sure that we all have this section in our grasp, that we understand it. Because if we want to understand biblical prophecy, that chapters 2 through 7 give us the backbone for it. So if we don't understand the beginning, then we can't really move on. So as I've mentioned before, chapters 2 through 7 are written in Aramaic. They form a literary unit and they primarily deal with Gentile nations. These chapters 2 through 7 are formed in an ABBA format. Fancy word is a chiasm, but it's just ABBA. So chapter 2 will mirror chapter 7. Chapter 3 will mirror chapter 6. And chapter 4 will mirror chapter 5. And, I mean, it's like an Oreo cookie. Right, the cream is on the inside. The point is made in the middle. It's focusing you to the middle. So you'll find the point of this literary unit in chapters 4 and 5. Chapters 2 and 7 give us a preview of world history. In chapter 2, we're given the Gentile king's vision of four future kingdoms of the earth: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And they appear to him as a magnificent statue, as a mighty work of human manufacturing. And then suddenly, this Gentile king sees a stone cut without hands. It is made without a human agent. And it strikes this statue at the base, at the feet, at the portion which represents the fourth and final kingdom. And when it strikes, all of the Gentile kingdoms are destroyed. They are destroyed immediately, completely, permanently. They gone, not coming back. And then this stone begins to grow into a mountain that fills the whole earth. It is a final kingdom. It is God's kingdom. It is a kingdom that will not be replaced. When we come to chapter 7, we're given God's perspective of the four kingdoms of man. They are not beautiful works of splendor to be admired. Instead, they are unreasoning animals. They're beasts that fail to recognize their Creator. And in the days of the final kingdom, this final beast, one comes, the Ancient of Days. He passes judgment, and that kingdom is destroyed. Rule is taken from all the kingdoms, and it is given to the Son of Man. Rule is taken from the nations, it's given to the Son of Man. This is the Psalm to Christ. As for me, says the Father, I have installed my king on Mount Zion, my holy mountain. Ask of me, and I will give the nations as your inheritance. That's taking place in Daniel chapter 7. He will set up a political kingdom on earth which will never be succeeded. It will never be destroyed. Now, chapters 3 and chapters 6 serve then as a warning. In chapter 3, the ones who try to destroy Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego by throwing them in the fiery furnace are instead destroyed by their own devices. In chapter 6, the ones who try to destroy Daniel in the lion's den are also destroyed by their own devices. So the warning to the nations is this. Beware that you don't oppose God's plan by trying to destroy God's people, lest you lie in wait for your own blood. You'll be caught by your own traps. You'll be destroyed by your own devices. And finally, that middle section, the cream in the Oreo cookie, chapter 4 and 5, we're shown two Gentile kings who magnify themselves, and they are humbled by God. And the point of the whole section, this chapter 2 all the way through chapter 7, is given, and it is this. The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and He bestows it on whom He wishes. God's running the joint, and He chooses who is stewarding this place for Him. The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and He bestows it on whomever He wishes. And we know ultimately His wish is to bestow it on His Son, the Son of Man, the Psalm to Christ, that Davidic King that's coming, that Israel is waiting for. Now, as we move into chapter 8, we're going to begin a new unit in this book. Daniel's going from Aramaic and now he's writing in Hebrew. And now the focus is no longer the Gentile nations and just general world history. The focus is going to be the prophetic history of the Jewish people during this period known as the time of the Gentiles. The time of the Gentiles. We discussed before, it is that period of time where there is no king in Israel and they are under Gentile domination. So it started with Babylon. Okay, 605, Daniel's taken to Babylon at the beginning of this book. And then it's continued all the way to today and into the future until God comes and sets up His kingdom. Jesus sets up His kingdom. So this could continue on until, according to Jesus in Matthew 24, the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. That's when Jesus is going to come. He will set up a final kingdom. Now, pick it up in verse 1. And in fact, I just want to read through this prophecy. We'll only be going through verse 8 today. The prophecy will continue, and in fact, after that point, it's going to jump 150 years into the future. But I want to deal with that prophecy with a little bit more length. So we're going to save that one for next time. But we're just going to go through to verse 8 today. So let's read it together. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. And then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other. And the longer one came up last. I saw the ram butting westward and northward and southward, and no other beasts could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came up to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. And he struck the ram and shattered his two horns. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him. And there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Now this is a very interesting text. The setting of the text is going to occur just like the previous one, chapter 7. This is during the reign of Belshazzar. This is before the exchange of power from Babylon to Medo-Persia. The previous one happened in the first year of the reign of Belshazzar. That last, remember, he's co-ruling with Nabonidus. This one happens a couple years later. The vision begins, chapter 8, verse 1, and we see that it happens in a place called Susa. Susa. What's interesting about Susa, right now, Susa is a city that's about 225 miles east of Babylon. It's really not an important city in Daniel's day. You know, it's kind of like a little Ben Wheeler in the Middle East. It's just this small little town. But in the future, it's going to become a very important city. Listen to this. Listen to what Nehemiah chapter 1 says. Verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakalah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital. We find the same thing in the first chapter of Esther, verse 2. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa. So Daniel is transported in a vision. Babylon is all he knows right now. He's transported in a vision, unbeknownst to him, to the capital of a future kingdom. It will be Persia. He's transported to the capital of Persia, and this is going to be the location that serves as his vision, in which he will watch the transition of power from Persia to the next world empire. That's what he's watching. We know that coming soon in chapter 5, he's going to witness the transition of power between Babylon and Medo-Persia. Hasn't happened yet. He's going straight to the future. Now notice it. Verse 3, what we read. I lifted my eyes and looked, and there was a ram which had two horns standing in front of the canal. And the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and the longer one came up last. I look at this ram and I say, well, who is this supposed to be? It is Medo-Persia, but how can we know that? Fortunately, with this prophecy, this very specific prophecy, like much of biblical prophecy, we don't even have to worry about seeking an interpretation. The Bible is going to give it to you. Daniel is visited. You can look at it in verses 15 through 17 by an angel. You'll notice it, verse 16, his name is Gabriel, and he is called to give Daniel understanding. He is a terrifying angel. He comes near to Daniel, and it says, verse 17, when he came, I was frightened. I fell on my face. But he said to me, son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. And now while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Translation, Daniel passed out. He was so afraid of this angel, he passes out. But Gabriel picks him up, he touches me, he made me to stand upright, he dusts him off. He says, okay, listen. Now notice it. Verse 20. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. So we know that it's the Medo-Persian Empire because Gabriel tells us. Now the ram which represents Persia, he pops up where the Persia's capital is going to be. And we're told he has two horns. Both are long, one's longer than the other. They don't pop up at the same time. And then the longer one comes up last. It pushes out at a later moment. And I find it interesting that these elements that we're discussing here with the ram, which represents Medo-Persia, also appear in the previous two visions of Medo-Persia. You may recall the first vision in chapter 2, the statue. Persia is the second kingdom, the one that succeeds Babylon. It is the silver chest with the arms. So I think of the two horns and I think of the two arms on this statue representing Medo-Persia. And I think of Medo-Persia as an empire that's really two nations. It's two empires in a co-confederacy. The Medes, the Persians. But that's not all. They're lopsided. All right, the horns are not the same length. And I'm reminded of chapter 7. Medo-Persia was pictured as the bear. The bear that was lopsided, right? It's the bear that was lifted up on one side. Now, the Persian Empire, we know, overshadowed the Median Empire. It was dominant. It overtook it. It basically folded up the Medes right up into it. Which is interesting, because the Medes were initially stronger. The Medes began as the stronger empire, but later Persia grew up and they grew strong and they overtook the Medes. Or as Daniel's vision prophesies, the longer one comes up last. Verse 4. I saw the ram, and it was budding westward and northward and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was anyone to rescue from his power. He did as he pleased. He magnified himself. Now, if you look at the Medo-Persian Empire, you can track how they advanced. To the east of Medo-Persia, you have India. You have the Orient. They don't go east. They go west. They capture and conquer Babylonia. They conquer Syria. They conquer Asia Minor. They try to attack Greece. They raid Greece several times. I think there was a movie out not too long ago, 300. You know, it's the Spartans and they're getting attacked by the Persians. And it's like 300 Spartans have the last stand and they kill a bunch, but they eventually die. That's about 100 years. Okay, into the past before this shaggy goat we're going to talk about in a second pops up. So during Persia's prime, they're raiding Greece. They're raiding Babylon and conquer it. They conquer the north in Armenia. They conquer the south. They conquer Egypt. They conquer Ethiopia. The Medo-Persian Empire greatly eclipsed the Babylonian Empire. And Babylonian, what's interesting is if you look at those four empires and you just kind of put them on top of one another, each time they're expanding to whatever the known world is at the time, they take over it. And it greatly eclipsed Babylon. But just as Nebuchadnezzar's vision foretold for his empire, that it wouldn't be final, it would be succeeded, so also he saw that the Medo-Persian Empire would not last forever. Verse 5. So he's observing. And he sees this male goat, and it comes from the west, and it flies over the surface. It doesn't even touch the ground. I mean, it's moving with some speed. And it has a conspicuous horn beneath his eyes. And he attacks this ram. He rushes him with his mighty wrath. He crushes him. He shatters him. He tramples him. There's no one to rescue the ram from his power. And we say, the ram from the shaggy goat's power. And we say, who is the shaggy goat? Shaggy goat is Greece. You say, how do we know, Caleb, that the shaggy goat is Greece? Gabriel's going to tell us. That's easy. Listen to it. 8:21. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is his first king. Do you know who the first king was of Greece? Alexander the Great, the first king of Greece. He was born in July of 356 BC. Keep in mind, Daniel is writing this in the 6th century. Way, way, way. He's long gone before Alexander comes up on the scene. Alexander is born in 356 BC. That's 4th century. He's the son of a brilliant leader, Philip of Macedonia. And Philip basically sets up the scene for him. Okay, Philip was a brilliant leader. He gets him an army. He gets him money. And he basically sets up a perfect storm for Alexander. Alexander was taught by Aristotle. That's his tutor. And when Alexander is 20 years old, his father is murdered. He's murdered by his lover through jealousy. He's killed. And Alexander inherits his father's army and his father's city-state. And when he's 22, 2 years later, listen to this, in 334 BC, Alexander attacks Persia with only 35,000 men. Alexander's forces plunged through the Granicus River, attacking Darius's 100,000 footmen and 10,000 horsemen, reportedly killing 20,000 at a loss of only 100 Greek troops. Complete victory was assured at the Battle of Issus the following year in 331 BC, which means within 3 years, Alexander conquered the entire Near East. What took the Medo-Persian Empire decades to do, Alexander does in just a few years. He's flying. Okay, he's a swift king taking over this kingdom. And you know, have you ever asked yourself, you ever wondered why the New Testament is written not in Hebrew, but in Greek? Alexander. He took over the place. And through some of his descendants, what's called Hellenization, Greekization, their culture is being forced upon all the people in the region, which is why our New Testament is in Greek. Now, there's a tradition, interestingly, recorded by Josephus. Josephus is a Jewish historian, and the tradition has that Alexander actually visited Jerusalem, but he doesn't plunder it. And the reason that he doesn't is because he receives a vision of someone approaching him in a white gown, the same kind of outfit that the high priest approaches Alexander in. Listen to this. This is an excerpt from Jewish Antiquities by Josephus. Josephus claims that this happened supposedly in 332 BC. He says, he, Alexander the Great, gave his hands to the high priest, and with the Jews running beside him, entered the city. Then he went up to the temple, where he sacrificed to God under the direction of the high priest, and showed due honor to the priests and to the high priest himself. And when the book of Daniel was shown to him, in which he had declared that one of the Greeks would destroy the Persian Empire, he believed himself to be the one indicated. And in his joy, he dismissed the multitude for the time being. But on the following day, he summoned them again and told them to ask for any gifts that they might desire. Possibly true. First century account. But Alexander's victory is going to be short-lived. Notice it, verse 8. The male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. He died. He died at age 32 from some unknown illness, a fever of some sorts. Now, when a king dies, who would you expect to take over the kingdom? Yeah, his heir, right? His son. Alexander had two sons. But you know what else the book of Daniel has to say about Alexander? Look at chapter 11, verse 3. Chapter 11, verse 3 is speaking of him. And chapter 11, verse 3 says this: a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded. For his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides him. His two sons are assassinated. The kingdom is broken up into four pieces. You see the same thing. Four horns grow up in chapter 8, verse 8. And Gabriel will say that these four horns, verse 22, are four kingdoms that arise from his nation, though not with his power. They are Alexander's four generals. His sons are assassinated. His kingdom is parceled up. They're given to his four generals. So I think back and I think, well, wait a minute. Now, what other images of Greece have we seen in the book of Daniel? Well, we've seen a leopard with four heads. I think, So I'm starting to see consistency. When I'm looking at biblical prophecy, particularly in the book of Daniel, but the same thing is true for Revelation. We're looking at a story, right? And the story is moving. The plot is moving. I can't just jump into the book of Matthew and expect to understand how the terms go. The assumption is that I've read everything leading up to that point. You know, they're not going to define kingdom, for example, there for me. The same is true here. As we're moving through the book of Daniel, we're picking up images, we're picking up content. I think of horns, I'm thinking of a king, I'm thinking of a ruler, I see a beast, I'm thinking of a kingdom. We're picking up content, and it's going to follow all the way through through the book, all the way to the end of Revelation. Now, when we get to verse 9, as I mentioned before, Daniel is going to jump deep into the future, 150 years further. And we're going to talk about a very important individual for Jewish history. An important individual for the Jews to know about, because he's going to be persecuting the fool out of them. He's going to be the Old Testament Antichrist. We're going to read all about him. Now, if we have in these few verses just to look at, I mentioned before we're going to look at 10 specific prophecies. 10 prophecies given 200 years at least in advance. What are they? He identifies a kingdom that will replace Babylon, Medo-Persia. He identifies the capital of that kingdom, Susa. He identifies that it will be a two-kingdom confederation, Medes, Persians. He identifies that one half will overtake the other half. The Persians did. He identifies that it is the weaker one that will grow to overtake the original one. It's true. The Persians did. They started off weaker than the Medes. They overtook them. He identifies the name of the kingdom that will replace Medo-Persia, Greece. He identifies the rapid speed of the conquest. 3 years, the whole world is overtaken. He identifies the first king as the conqueror. It's a kingdom that conquers with its first king, Alexander the Great. He identifies that he will die young. Alexander dies at 32, right when he's strong, right when he conquers the world. He sat and wept because there was nowhere else to conquer. Then he died. And he identifies that upon his dying, his kingdom will not go to his descendants. It's going to go 4 different ways. And it does. To his 4 generals. So I look at these prophecies. They're amazing. This isn't some pie in the sky. Okay, some general, I see 2 suns and there's chaos and calamity and you can kind of apply it to whatever you want in your time. It's specific. The Lord, it's like when in Isaiah 45 and he's talking about the leader of Persia. My servant Cyrus, the one who I call by name. He's the God of details. And he's laying out very specifically how history is going to unfold. So I look at that. I think of the prophecies in the future. You know, John, in the book of John, it's the book of 7 signs. And those are things that Jesus does to demonstrate that he is the Christ. He is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And he writes those so that we'll know and believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing have life in his name. And I think about those, and they are amazing. But I think that there's something even more amazing than the fulfillment of these prophecies. One direct fulfillment or 5 direct fulfillments are amazing. But I think as we go through the story, we are beginning to pick up something that the author is doing that's just incredible. And that is the literary facts of the story. Alexander is great. Jesus is greater. Why? Because he is the Old Testament. He is the fulfillment of prophecy, but he's more than that. He is the Old Testament. Okay? He is the greater Adam. He is the greater Noah. He is the greater Joseph. He is the greater Moses. He is the greater David. He is the greater Elijah. He is the greater Daniel. He is the Old Testament prophecy. He is that piece that fits into a story in such a way that no one else can do it. One piece missing, you fail. That's amazing. You look at this text, 40 different authors, over 1,400 years, and yet there's a story arc. There is a setting, there is a conclusion. I look at it and there's two sides all the way through. God's character, Satan's character. Seed of the woman, seed of the serpent. God's city, Jerusalem. Man's city, Babylon. God's kingdom, pictured by a stone. Man's kingdom, this magnificent statue. Resurrected Israel, resurrected Rome. Resurrected Christ, resurrected Antichrist. And it's all leading to that final conclusion. All these arcs are coming down at the end. That's incredible. That's impossible. That's divine. That's divine.